I'm surprised that you would come in here and take the position that you're taking now, because the decision cost us $1 million, and it may have cost us millions more in the future.
Lawmakers grill the governor's pick for attorney general. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 17th of March. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, scientists look for lessons from the Japanese earthquake.
One day after the earthquake, we probably know more about the Japanese earthquake than we did a decade after the 1964 earthquake.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust.
Alaska's Attorney General Designee John J. Burns stands by his advice to Governor Sean Parnell that the Federal Health Care Reform Act is unconstitutional. The advice cost the state at least $1 million in grant funding, which Parnell last month chose not to pursue under the act. Burns faced tough questions about health care and other issues at a confirmation hearing yesterday. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
When a Florida judge ruled the Health Care Reform Act unconstitutional in a case brought by 26 states, including Alaska, Governor Sean Parnell declared it the law of the land, saying he'd relied on the advice of his choice for Attorney General, John J. Burns. Reading from a prepared statement before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Burns defended his input to the governor.
By filing the lawsuit that it did, Alaska submitted to the jurisdiction of the court and must follow the court's decision. Thus, to the extent that the Affordable Care Act requires any action or implementation by the state of Alaska, it was binding law on the state of Alaska.
Several legal experts, including a lawyer for the legislature, disagree. They say a decision issued in a judicial district outside Alaska has no binding effect in the state, and the health care litigation will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Florida judge essentially took that position 2 weeks ago when he issued a stay against his own ruling. Parnell last month declined to apply for a $1 million grant under the health care law to set up a state-run exchange program to give insurance information to Alaskans. Anchorage Senator Bill Welikowski was one of several Senate Democrats who urged the governor to apply for those funds. Welikowski, a lawyer, took Burns to task for not admitting he gave bad advice.
I'm surprised that you would come in here and take the position that you're taking now, because the decision cost us $1 million, and it may have cost us millions more in the future.
With different opinions on whether the ruling was binding, Welikowski asked Burns why he didn't tell the governor to play it safe and apply for the funds.
Why wouldn't you have just erred on the side and said, you know what, it's probably a good idea, let's just apply for the funds, and then if we get this clarified once and for all, we can always just turn back the funds.
Burns said he believes the judge's ruling was the law when the state was facing the grant deadline. With the judge's stay now in effect, he says Parnell plans to implement the Reform Act while the state awaits the next decision in the case.
At this juncture, my understanding is that the governor fully intends to honor his obligation under the law, and that law currently is implementation.
In addition to the health care litigation, the Parnell administration has filed or threatened to file at least 5 lawsuits against the federal government on issues it sees as threatening development. It's also filed to intervene in lawsuits brought by other parties. Burns said the state's first course of action should always be dialogue, but it should reserve the right to sue.
We must be willing to pull that arrow from the quiver when it is necessary to protect our interests as a state, because the future of our state is critically dependent on resource development, responsible resource development.
Burns said dialogue is also important in tribal sovereignty cases. He said he's been to Barrow twice and Bethel and Nome once each since being appointed in December. Much of his work has focused on the governor's initiative to stop domestic violence and sexual assault. Burns says the biggest issue facing the Department of Law right now is finding young lawyers to replace the ones getting ready to retire.
I think it's about 25% paralegals and attorneys are eligible currently for retirement. And the Department of Law provides really one thing, and that's brain power. And when these individuals who have such incredible depth of knowledge and institutional memory leave, we are going to be hurting.
The committee forwarded Burns' name to the full legislature for consideration. He'll get a confirmation hearing in the House Judiciary Committee on Friday. Before being tapped as Attorney General, Burns worked in private practice in Fairbanks for nearly 25 years, specializing in commercial litigation, business transactions, property law, and insurance defense. He'll be 52 years old later this month, and while he's 3 years older than Governor Parnell, they both attended law school at the University of Puget Sound. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Pick, Click, Give program is getting about double the number of donations this year than it did last year. The Rasmussen Foundation today announced that 3.5% of Alaskans are taking part in the program that redirects money from their permanent fund dividends to nonprofit organizations within the state. That's up from 1.6% at this time last year. The foundation has been the driving force behind the program. Chairman Ed Rasmussen said there had been some early concern about public participation this year, given the national economic condition.
Alaskans, by and large, are pretty generous. And we felt that we had to support this program in good times and bad times, and we wanted to keep the momentum up, and it's already shown that what we've done is we've doubled the amount of contributions.
Rasmussen said the program is on its way to becoming part of the state's culture, and he hopes to see it continue to grow in popularity. The deadline for requesting permanent fund dividends is the end of this month. The U.S. House has voted to slash funding for National Public Radio. The Republican-led effort passed 228-192. Congressman Don Young does not support the cut, but he didn't cast a vote. APRN's Libby Casey has more.
Congressman Young missed the vote because he's giving the keynote speech at a Native American economic summit in Las Vegas. But his spokeswoman says he would have voted no on defunding NPR. That's significant because only 7 Republicans cast no votes. Young was not available to comment to APRN Thursday. No Democrats voted for the bill. It cuts NPR's funding and federal money to radio stations to pay NPR programming fees. The bill now goes to the Senate. Debate on the House floor ranged from passionate speeches by Democrats in support of NPR's mission and programming to slams by Republicans who said taxpayer dollars should not pay for it. NPR is under scrutiny after a conservative activist recorded a secret video of the company's former top fundraiser, Ron Schiller, in what the executive didn't realize was a fake set-up business meeting. The video was edited to show Schiller's comments in the worst light. Meanwhile, the Senate Thursday passed a 3-week-long spending bill. It's already cleared the House, so it will keep the government running until April 8th. Both of Alaska's senators voted for the bill, which passed 87-13. The no votes came from 9 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and 1 liberal independent. It includes $6 billion in spending cuts. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a solution to the high cost of fielding a competitive Iditarod team.
Partnering up is probably the way to go as far as helping training, but also being able to afford it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
It's hard to fathom right now, but some good will eventually come out of the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. Japan has the best seismic monitoring network in the world, and because of that, last week's disaster will offer a lot of lessons for other earthquake-prone areas around the globe, like Alaska. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
About 20 minutes after the 9.0 earthquake hit Japan, large seismic waves began rolling across Alaska.
The ground everywhere around us, every building, every person, moved up and down about a half an inch.
That's Mike West, a seismologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The half inch of movement was for the interior, south central, and southeast Alaska. In the western Aleutians, the seismic wave was much larger, moving the earth an inch and a half. Those are impressive numbers.
And you might ask, well, why don't we recognize that? Why did no one feel this? And that's because it happens very slowly over the course of 30 seconds or a minute. But several times we went up and down riding the seismic waves.
Wes says that movement didn't have any lasting impact on Alaska and didn't increase the earthquake risk here. The Japanese earthquake was the same kind as the 1964 Good Friday earthquake in south central Alaska. They're called megathrust earthquakes and occur where one tectonic plate is forced under another. Peter Heusler is head of the Earthquakes Hazards Project with the United States Geological Survey in Anchorage. He says Japan has invested heavily in technology to understand and document these earthquakes.
There's no doubt that we're going to learn a ton from this earthquake.
And that's going to allow for an unprecedented level of new research opportunities.
I mean, I've already seen plots of data that, you know, one day after the earthquake, we probably know more about the Japanese earthquake than we did after a decade after the 1964 earthquake, for example.
Heusler says scientists will scrutinize the details of how the earthquake ruptured to improve building safety. He also expects the disaster to shed light on how tsunamis are generated. And he says because the Japanese put a lot of effort into emergency response, there will be a lot of lessons there as well.
I think no doubt in the long run, despite the tragedy in Japan, I think this earthquake will end up making Alaska a safer place.
And just how prepared is Alaska for a similar event? Heusler says there are a number of factors to consider, but he says a lot of earthquake safety boils down to one thing.
It's often said that earthquakes don't kill people, buildings do. And so it's incredibly important to have good building codes that are well implemented.
Heusler says Anchorage does have good building codes, but many smaller communities in the state do not. He says South Central Alaska isn't due for another 9-magnitude earthquake, but he says some signs do point to the potential for an 8-magnitude quake. Heusler says it's impossible to say if that would happen this year or 100 years from now. Being able to give a detailed earthquake forecast is considered the holy grail of earthquake science.
Thus far, people have looked very, very hard for these telltale signs that the big one is coming, and they haven't been able to nail it down.
Heusler says researchers will be combing through the Japanese earthquake data for new clues. But whether or not earthquake forecasts ever become a reality, he says the main lesson from the Japanese disaster is that Alaskans need to be prepared. UAF's Mike West agrees. He says it's humbling to see the devastation in Japan.
Japan has a level of monitoring, a level of public education, a level of infrastructure robustness that is hard to match anywhere else. They set a very, very high bar and still suffer considerable damages from an event like this.
And Alaska's history with big earthquakes makes the case for preparation even stronger. Wes says three of the largest earthquakes since 1900 have occurred in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Alaska State Employees Association has begun a recruiting drive to unionize the last unorganized University of Alaska employee group. The ASEA began seeking interest cards from the 2,500 member support staff group yesterday on campuses in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
ASEA organizers say a dozen UAF staff members filled out cards Wednesday expressing their support to join the union during the 2 hours that the organizers had set up a table outside the Wood Campus Center. They said that's not bad for a slow day in the middle of spring break when, like the students, a lot of UAF employees are taking time off. Ginny Redmond, an academic coordinator with Student Support Services and ASEA Organizing Committee member, says staffers who turned in the cards were motivated by recent health insurance cost increases, reductions in coverage, and other changes.
There's a lot of dramatic changes to what's currently being offered, and I don't think a lot of people are satisfied with the answers that they've been given as far as why those changes are taking place.
Dan Lasota, another organizing committee member, says union representation would give university staff a voice in negotiations over health insurance and other workplace issues.
Right now we have zero voice in, you know, that whole decision. We had no say in it. And unless we really get together, we're going to have no say in future reductions to our benefits.
University administrators announced last month that the changes were needed to save $8 million in the coming fiscal year to deal with rising health care costs. The changes and lack of an ability to influence them is what motivated Erica Keiko Isseri to fill out an ASEA card.
And I think it's really important for us to have a voice, especially with the recent health care changes.
Redmond says staff deserve the right to collective bargaining, just like faculty and just about all other university employees.
So the faculty are organized, the trades and crafts are organized, and you know, we'd like to be able to have that same ability to negotiate for our working conditions.
Lasota, a webpage designer with the College of Engineering and Mines, says a union will help staff negotiate with administration for health plan cost increases and coverage reductions proposed for fiscal 2013 and beyond.
There is a difference between negotiating your working conditions rather than just being told this is the way things are going to be.
Lasota says he's optimistic that the union will quickly collect the minimum of 300 cards from UAF and the total of 800 from university staff statewide that's required to hold an election in early summer on whether staff should become part of ASEA Local 52. But he says the organizing committee won't stop there. They'll seek to double that number, 600 from UAF, 1,600 statewide, both to ensure success and to send a strong message. Beth Boehner, the university's chief human resources officer, declined Wednesday to comment on the union organizing activity. Tom Rhodes, the business agent for ASEA Local 52, says that despite concerns expressed by some university administrators over union organizing, they have so far complied with state labor law.
We have not been shut out. We have not been told we can't communicate. We have not been told that we can't attend functions or in other be barred in any way. I think they're a little cautious, but I don't really understand what their caution is. I mean, all these folks are looking to do is to have a voice in the workplace like all the other workers within their entire university system.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
Several of the competitive dog teams in this year's Iditarod were the result of cooperative agreements between mushers. As APRN Iditarod Trail reporter Tim Bodoni reports, these cooperative arrangements could become more common in the years ahead.
Norwegian mushers managed the dog pooling system to great success in the early part of the last decade. Some Canadian and American mushers doubted whether the Norwegian dog pooling system would catch on here. They found it hard to believe that many kennel owners would surrender so much control over training, race strategy, and winnings, not to mention dogs, to someone else. But for personal and financial reasons, more competitive distance mushers are turning to dog pooling as the best way to get a team in the Iditarod and other major races. Sebastian Schnula is one such musher. The 2009 Yukon Quest champion had his own kennel in Whitehorse and did most of the hard work of raising and training dogs by himself. Burned out and ready for a lifestyle change, Schnula said he would be leaving distance mushing after the 2010 season and sold off most of his dogs. But he was back for the 2011 Iditarod and finished in sixth place with a team that grew out of dog-sharing arrangements with both Jesse Royer and Aaron Burmeister, added to a core of his favorite old dogs. During a break in this year's race at Caltag, Schnula said that the opportunity to get all of Burmeister's team last fall got him thinking about Iditarod again.
It was just the fact that Aaron wanted to take another year of a break. It is better for the dogs to run than to sit. And they're relatively young dogs, you know, so this is kind of their first experience.
In the deal, Schnula gets to keep the prize money from his sixth place finish in Iditarod this year, in exchange for Burmeister having access to Schnula's veteran dogs in the future. Schnula insists that a bond of mutual trust has to exist between the musher and every dog on his team, regardless of where they came from. So if he didn't click with the Burmeister dog early in their training, he sent it back. In the end, Schnula got a dog team to the starting line without having to commit to the cost and exhaustion of managing a large kennel. And for guys like him, he says, that's the best way to go.
I've never been much into raising puppies and breeding. You need a pretty big operation for that. A lot of people to help. I don't believe in giving my young dogs to dog handlers. Dogs know nothing, handlers know nothing, very bad combo. Families like Lance, you know, or the CVs and so on, they had a whole different thing. It just never worked for me. I have to work for a living between training a race team and raising puppies and working. There's just, forget it, I just don't have the time.
Trent Herbst also decided to enter a dog-sharing partnership because he didn't want to make a long-term commitment to the sport. The Ketchum, Idaho-based Iditarod veteran didn't want to simply lease a team for a few months or continue to run puppy teams for other mushers like he had in the past. Instead, he found a better option in teaming up with his friend Jake Berkowitz, the winner of this year's Copper Basin 300. Both got their start in mushing as handlers for Ed Steelstra in Michigan. When Berkowitz got an opportunity to buy a high-quality dog team last year, Herbst came on board as a co-investor. As part of the deal, Herbst got a team for this year's Iditarod.
I'm not into this for the long term like Jake is, but I would also love to see Jake win this thing. And I think Jake is going to, especially with this dog team and especially with the breeding he's going to do with it. So with that, we just kind of laid out a cost and what would be fair and helped Jake buy his team and start breeding. And then it also got me to a more competitive team instead of running yearlings for people. And it worked out great for both of us.
Herp says that next year, he and Berkowitz will have two teams in competition. Berkowitz will drive the top team in the Yukon Quest, and Herbst will take the less experienced yearling team. For the Iditarod, they'll switch. They might have high hopes for their dogs, but Berkowitz and Herbst have yet to figure out how the partnership will handle the fruit of their labor.
We haven't really sorted out prize money. Is, you know, it's such a little part of the, I guess, the payback for the kennel. Most of it will come in sponsorship or basically both of us work. And Jake works up on the Glacier in Juneau in the tourist industry, and I teach down in Sun Valley, Idaho, and that's basically how we afford this.
Like Schnula, Herbst believes that a musher needs to work with a dog team for an entire season to build a solid relationship, and that dog-sharing partnerships that don't acknowledge that will not survive. It may not be the route that all competitive mushers will take, but for someone like Trent Herbst, the decision to give up some control of your dogs in exchange for lower costs and commitments makes good sense.
Especially for young people that are not established yet in the sport, partnering up is probably the way to go as far as helping training, but also being able to afford it. And I think you're going to see more of the competitive teams in the future being partnerships.
In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
The 1A and 2A state basketball tournaments wrapped up last night in Anchorage. With the championship games fresh on their minds, players and coaches thought back not only to the wins that got them there, but other more intangible factors as well. APRN's Josh Edge was at the Sullivan Arena.
When asked to talk about the season, players and coaches usually seem to come back to one thing, the leadership of the seniors. Skagway senior Kaylee O'Daniel emotionally spoke about what winning the state championship meant to the graduating players.
And it means a lot to us because there's three of us seniors who have been leading this team for a long time. We really wanted this win, especially this being our last game. It was a good feeling.
Skagway beat Yakutat 34-23 to win the 2A girls title. Players don't really even seem to need the encouragement of coaches to step up and lead. They just want it the most, and the rest of the team follows in their footsteps. Port Lions coach Dana Strong sees this as his team's greatest strength.
The thing of it is that our secret weapon, I always tell everyone, is character. These kids have tremendous character. They're not partiers. They get good grades. They never miss practice. They want to be at practice. They want to win. They'll throw their bodies all around. It is amazing to coach them, and they're led by the seniors who have taught them that and have been a big part of that. And I'm a big believer in that. Let the seniors lead, and they have, and they've done awesome.
Port Lions defended their 1A girls state title, beating Kivalina 46-37. ANIAC coach Wayne Morgan explained to his nephew Bruce Morgan that leadership is a quality that doesn't only apply to how someone plays, but how they act as well.
At first practice, I pulled him over to the side and I said, "You're the leader of this team, Bruce, and I want you to end your senior year in style. And you're gonna do this by leading the other players, your team. You're not gonna do any bad sportsmanship. You're gonna let them follow what you do out on the floor. Play hard, play aggressive, good sportsmanship. Stay eligible. Good attitude on the floor."
ANIAC defeated New Haven 67-58 to win the 1A boys championship. Sometimes, those who lead on the court are also leaders in their community. Point Hope coach Leonard Barger says that senior Adam Sage is one of those players.
When he goes out hunting and stuff, you know, when there's somebody, you know, that lost a loved one, you know, he'll go out there and hunt for them. You know, and I love Adam so much, you know, he doesn't think for himself, he thinks for those people.
Tikigak beat Klawak 74-56, winning the 2A boys title for the third straight year. The 3A and 4A tournaments started this morning and will continue through Saturday. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska, Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.